Welcome to another edition of Stuck in the Middle Radio Show with Alan Edwards. And yes, I am Alan Edwards. And boy, do we have a special show for you today. I think you're going to enjoy this one. So you have got to whip out a cup of wine or heat yourself up a cup of tea. Whip open a beer, because this one is going to be a bumpy ride, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very special speech, a Q&A, from Tony Schwartz. And if you don't know anything about Tony, which you should, and if you don't, I'm just going to fill you in right now. He is the author of The Art of the Deal by so-called Donnie Trump. Donald didn't write one word of that book. It was Tony Schwartz. He did the whole thing. He had to basically put it all together. You're going to hear how that worked out, because he gave an amazing speech at Oxford Union with a Q&A afterwards, and I'm going to share it with you. It's an amazing speech that's going to send chills down your spine out of some of the stuff he says about Donald Trump. One of the things that's chilling about this speech and the timing of it is that he actually gave this 10 days before the election. So keep that in mind, because what this man says and how he was able to read Donald Trump is exactly what's happening now with the Trumpster. This guy knew Donald Trump inside and out. I shouldn't say knew. He knows Donald Trump inside and out. And it's just a bone-chilling, jaw-dropping speech that's very interesting, very enlightening, and you're going to enjoy this. So cuddle up, get ready, give yourself about an hour, because we're going in. Check this out.
Good evening, everybody. So wonderful to see such a big crowd. First, I want to thank you all very much for either being part of inviting me to be part of this distinguished speaker series, or for coming out to hear this tonight. I'm deeply honored to be included among the extraordinary people who have spoken before me in this historic venue. But why am I here? I'm someone who, until several months ago, you most likely had never heard of. Two explanations, oddly paradoxical. The first one is that I made a decision early in my adult life to write a book with a brash, young, moderately successful real estate developer who was mostly unknown outside the United States. Actually, he was mostly unknown even outside New York City at that time. 30 years later, this man did something I could never have imagined possible when I met him. He decided to run for president of the United States. And 10 days from now, that man, God save us, could become the leader of the free world. It's a terrifying thought. And indeed, more specifically, I'm here tonight because shortly before Donald Trump won the Republican nomination for president back in July, I made a decision to publicly renounce the book I had written and the man whose image and persona I had helped to shape and define. Tonight, I want to talk to you about who Donald Trump is and why I believe he represents such a dangerous threat to the future of our planet. And I also want to talk to you about the journey that led me from serving as Trump's Boswell in my mid-30s to becoming in my mid-60s one of his most visible and clamorous critics. I began my career as a journalist, motivated by two often conflicting ambitions. On the one hand, I'd been raised by two parents who were deeply committed to public service. My father was a scientist and an educator. My mother was a social activist and a pioneering feminist. I grew up believing deeply that I had a responsibility to be of service to others in my life and to make a positive difference in the world. I also grew up with a burning ambition to stand out individually, to be recognized as special by as many people as possible. As effective as my parents were in their work in the world, they were deeply flawed as caregivers. As a child, I never had the feeling of being deeply loved or lovable. I grew up burdened by a deep sense of inadequacy and a fierce hunger to prove my own value by way of visible external accomplishments. I imagine that feeling is not foreign to some of you who are here tonight. Influenced by the conflicting messages I got from my parents, I arrived into adulthood with a deep conflict between serving others and serving myself, between doing what I perceived was the right thing and doing whatever was necessary to feel more safe and secure in the world and to attract notice. Journalism seemed like a good way to combine the two, to be publicly noticed and appreciated as a writer, and to do good, as H.L. Mencken once put it, by afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. It was while working for the magazine New York that I first encountered Donald Trump. At the time, Trump was a 38-year-old real estate developer who had achieved some renown in New York by building a very successful hotel atop Grand Central Station on 42nd Street, and then a flashy condominium in a prized midtown location, which he modestly named Trump Tower. In early 1985, I got wind that Trump had purchased an existing apartment building overlooking New York Central Park South. It was another prized location. But in this case, the tenants in the building were living under the protection of rent control and rent stabilization and paid very low rent. Trump's plan was to get rid of them and turn the building into a luxury condominium. To help in that effort, he hired a company that specialized in what was known as relocation or tenant relocation. But what that really meant was purposely breaking the elevators so that tenants were forced to walk up and down 15 flights of stairs, not replacing broken lights in the hallways or purposely breaking the lights, and generally refusing to do any kind of repairs. All this was designed to make life sufficiently miserable and unbearable for the tenants that they felt they had no choice but to move out. That, of course, was story enough. But the delicious addendum was that Trump was failing miserably in his efforts to get rid of these tenants. In the article I wrote, I described his efforts as a case study in how not to vacate a building. The story of a gang that couldn't shoot straight, a fugue of failure, a farce of bumbling and fumbling. The cover image for the article featured an illustration of Trump looking like a thug, red-faced, sweating, scowling. He loved it. And he especially loved the cover photo. Tough guy. And he called to tell me so. He wanted to be a tough guy, and he immediately had this cover framed and put it up on the wall over his desk. And I realized that Trump was like no one I had ever met. He was a journalist's dream because wherever he went, he tended to do something outrageous. And that's never changed. Several months later, I went back to interview him for another story, and a few minutes into our conversation, he mentioned that he just signed a deal with the publisher Random House, prestigious publisher, to do a book. "What's it about?" I asked. "It's my autobiography," he replied. "You're only 38, I said. "You don't have an autobiography yet." "Yeah, I know," he said, "but I'm getting paid a lot of money to do it, and I'm going to do it." "If you're going to write a book," I said spontaneously, "you ought to call it The Art of the Deal. People are a lot more interested in deals than they are in your autobiography. The title had just popped into my head. I like that, Trump said. You want to write it? As much as it makes me cringe to say this to you today, I was hoping he would say that. I already knew that Trump was a bad actor. I'd just done this piece, which was plenty of evidence, and that writing a book with him would very likely undermine my future credibility as a journalist. It would also subject me to the legitimate charge of having sold out. The term was invented for what I was about to do. On the other hand, my wife and I had two young children. We were both journalists making modest salaries, and I was unduly worried about our financial situation. Writing Trump's book, I rationalized, could create security for my family and free me to do whatever I wanted next. What I really did was I told myself a story that somehow made it okay to do this book. I pushed my concerns about the kind of man he was into the background. And I'm reminded of something that Jeb Magruder, who was one of the Richard Nixon aides who got caught up in the Watergate scandal, said about himself, looking back some number of years later. Somewhere between my ambition and my ideals, he wrote, I lost my moral compass. I did the same. And having done so, I focused on making the most of my opportunity. Most writers for hire receive a flat fee or a relatively modest percentage of any money that the book earns. Trump and I haggled back and forth, the art of the deal, and ultimately he agreed to give me 50% of the $500,000 advance. My $250,000 share in 1987, 86, was five times as much as I had ever earned in any year as a journalist. He also agreed to share 50% of any future royalties that the book earned. My mother, in particular, was appalled. She disdained any focus on making money, and by writing this book, I was putting my finger in her eye. And although I didn't realize it at the time, it was my declaration of independence from her, perversely. Once the contract was signed, I arranged to meet Trump on Saturday mornings at his penthouse apartment in Trump Tower. My plan was to interview him for 2 or 3 hours at a time until I gathered enough material to write the book. I imagined it would take several dozen such meetings over the subsequent 6 or 8 months. It didn't take me long to realize I was kidding myself. In our very first interview, Trump became impatient after answering my questions. After just a few minutes, he was more than willing to provide sound bites to virtually any reporter who called him at his office any time, but it was nearly impossible to keep him focused on any single topic for more than 5 or 10 minutes. He had a stunningly short attention span. This is so boring, he would tell me with irritation a few minutes into any interview we did. I don't want to talk about what already happened. It's the past, it's over. If I managed to keep Trump answering my questions for 20 minutes, I considered it a major victory. He was like a kindergartner who couldn't sit still in a classroom. My strong guess is that Trump has never read a book in his adult life, with the possible exception of those written for him, and very likely not most of those. I know from the red marks he made that he read the manuscript I wrote. At one point, Trump agreed to let me accompany him to Mar-a-Lago, his home in Florida, for a weekend. My plan was to jam in a whole series of interviews over 48 hours so I could get progress on this book I was struggling to get done. His then wife, Ivana, there have been a bunch, made it clear that she wasn't happy to have me there. And that was understandable. He worked long hours during the week, didn't spend time with them. And each time she walked by us with one or another of his then three young kids in tow, she glared icily at me and at him. I felt abashed. He didn't seem to notice or care a bit. Trump was about Trump. He had almost no interest in his wife or his children. What I didn't know at the time is that he was actively carrying on an affair with Marla Maples, the woman who would eventually and briefly become his second wife. More important to this story, long before lunch, Trump stood up and announced that he couldn't stand to answer any more of my questions. Didn't I have enough? Plainly, I wasn't going to get a book's worth of material by trying to interview Trump. Instead, when we returned to New York, I simply began to show up at his office, most mornings around 9 a.m., and invariably Trump was on the phone when I arrived. With his permission, his delighted permission, were he to have been able to have another 10,000 or 10 million people listening, that would have been good from his perspective, I would pick up an extension 8 feet away from him and listen in on his conversations for the next several hours and often all day long, over 6 months, and then intermittently over the following year as I wrote the book. As I look back, three qualities beyond his inability to focus strike me as alarming when I imagine him as president. The first is his utter disregard for the truth and his lack of conscience about that fact. The second is that he is guided entirely by what he perceives as his immediate self-interest. And the third is his inability to ever admit that he's wrong about anything. None of those qualities seem highly desirable in a president. Beside reporters, Trump spoke mostly during the day with lawyers and bankers and brokers on deals he was doing. These people became a primary source of material for the book. After each call, or I should say after those calls, I would go out and interview them to fill in the details that Trump was incapable of providing to me himself. And it was in these conversations that I realized I couldn't take anything that Trump told me at face value. The accounts of these others often directly contradicted Trump's, and often they casually shared documents with me that supported what they were saying. I was concerned, but I rationalized that I was writing a book for hire. It wasn't meant to be my version of the events or even an objective account. This was his story, and he was sticking to it, even in the face of the most undeniable evidence to the contrary. More than any human being I have ever met, Trump has the ability to convince himself that whatever he's saying at any given moment is true, or sort of true, or at least ought to be true. To this day, lying is second nature to him, just one more way to gain advantage. If he was challenged about his facts, he doubled down. Still does it today. Trump does not admit to being wrong. He just keeps huffing and puffing till he blows you down. Often the lies he told were about money. How much he had paid for something, or what a building he owned was worth, or how much one of his casinos was earning, even when they were on the verge of bankruptcy. I wrestled with how to tell stories that I knew included inaccuracies, and eventually I came up with this sentence aimed at covering all potential untruths. Quote, people want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. It's called truthful hyperbole. It's an innocent form of exaggeration and a very effective form of promotion. It's also insane. There is no such thing as truthful hyperbole. Hyperbole is untruthful. But it was charming, and we got away with it. In the end, I created a character in Trump far more winning than he actually is. I never found him winning, or especially intelligent, or particularly interesting. But he was undeniably an effective self-promoter, and that book went on to be a number one bestseller around the world. What I did figure out in the course of doing that book was how to transmute his voice in ways that allowed him to come off not as cynical and one-dimensional, which he was, but rather to be kind of boyish and ingenuous and even charming. Here, for example, is how I had Trump introduce himself in The Art of the Deal. "I don't do it for the money. I've got enough, much more than I'll ever need. I do it to do it. Other people paint beautifully or write wonderful poetry. I like making deals, preferably big deals. That's how I get my kicks." In fact, Trump did do it for the money. He never believed he had enough, just as he never could get enough attention. He didn't do anything just to do it, and he certainly didn't think of his deals as poetry, because the word poetry was not part of his limited vocabulary. Trump did get a kick out of making big deals, but the kick never lasted for long, and he was always ravenous for the next one. Over time, I began to think of this man as a black hole. There was nothing to sustain him inside, so he looked entirely to the external world for nourishment. No amount of money or success or praise or attention was ever enough. I never saw any evidence that Trump had deep convictions or guiding core values, which helps explain why he can shift positions so effortlessly and unashamedly from one day to the next. Every belief of Trump's struck me as negotiable for the right price or the right advantage. His most abiding commitment and obsession and passion was proving to others that he was a winner, whatever that seemed to require on any given day, and then broadcasting his success, whether or not it was actually a success, as far and as wide as possible. As long as I was working on this book, Trump was likely to call me at any time of day or night. My wife, Deborah, often answered the phone when he called. Over a year and a half, she reminded me recently, Trump never once remembered her name, nor the names of my children, or perhaps even that I had children. He knew my name, but not much more about me because he never asked. I was there to do a job, and conversations with Trump are one way. I didn't take it personally. But this also helps to explain why he had no sustaining friends. Friendships for Trump were entirely functional. He was friendly to people who helped make his deals happen and unfriendly to those who stood in his way. Friendships came and went just as did his wives and his girlfriends. Indeed, with the exception of anger, Trump didn't traffic much in emotions of any sort, with the exception of anger. He could fly into a brief rage if he was challenged about any of his pronouncements, most notably his net worth, which he equated with his personal worth, and therefore constantly inflated. But just as often, Trump used his anger as a means to an end, an act he put on when he thought it served him well, and then dropped as soon as he felt it got him what he wanted. The same was true about Trump's beliefs. His ideology amounted to this: whatever, so long as I win and people notice. I fully recognize that I have painted an extreme portrait of this man, and that the vast majority of human beings, virtually all human beings, are more complex than the man I've just described. I also think that his extremity helps to explain why he's been an object of fascination for so long. In my own case, I believe I was drawn to Trump in part because he represented what Jung would have called the shadow side of myself. Trump grew up with a brutal father and a mother with whom he seems to have had virtually no relationship. It's oversimplifying to say that who he is a product of having lacked love and care as a child, and that he spent and his entire life looking for it in the external world, but it's also true. My own childhood was less extreme, certainly, than Trump's, but I recognized my experience in his. The hunger for unconditional love and acceptance exists in all of us, and its absence is always a source of suffering. Trump wears his most primitive instincts, his greed and his grandiosity, his lust and his envy right there on his sleeve. Most of us do a better job than he does at keeping these sorts of feelings under wraps. It's much easier to see Trump as absolutely alien to what we all stand for than it is to recognize aspects of himself in ourselves. But what compromises have you made in your own life? Where have you rationalized and explained away decisions that were less than honorable or ethical or kind? Where have you put your immediate self-interest ahead of others? Which parts of yourself do you hide from others, and perhaps even from yourself? Writing a book with Donald Trump was a way I could live out these instincts in myself. My hungry desire for more money and fame, vicariously, and without taking direct responsibility for them. I wasn't much older than most of you are today when I wrote The Art of the Deal. At the time, I told myself that doing it wasn't that big a deal and wouldn't have any enduring consequences. Ha. The truth is that that decision, the book and my association with Trump, has quietly haunted and dogged me for 30 years. In many ways, the rest of my life has been a reaction to having written The Art of the Deal. The next book I wrote was called What Really Matters? Searching for Wisdom in America. My aim was to get as far as possible from the values that Trump represented. Instead, I wanted to hang out and write about people who had led more reflective and intentional lives, who had goals beyond their own immediate self-interest. But interestingly, in 5 years of meeting and working with psychologists and philosophers, scientists and mystics who'd spend their own lives searching for higher wisdom, what I found was complexity and contradiction. I met people who were often stirring in their words and skilled in their practices, but these same people were also capable of devolving to more primitive behaviors and being blind to the contradiction between their walk and their talk. I think of this now as our shared infinite capacity for self-deception. Over most of the past 2 decades, I've run a company called The Energy Project. We've focused on helping people and companies to manage their work more skillfully, to fuel their own energy more skillfully, and as a result, to live happier and more productive lives. I'm proud of the work we've done, but I've also been humbled by it. In the years following The Art of the Deal, I wanted deeply to feel better about who I was and to believe that it was possible to reach some form of enlightenment, to get to the promised land, to truly move toward selflessness. If Trump represented one extreme of human behavior, I wanted the other extreme. And I want to leave you at this moment with a more nuanced perspective that is the product of these 30 years of searching that have characterized my life. Most of you are just entering adulthood. You've invested a great deal to get where you are today, to this very special place that many regard as the ticket to a successful life. And in some real measure, that's true. It's an extraordinary privilege to have an Oxford education, and it's an advantage. But whatever you may learn at Oxford, it's truly only the beginning of your education. I myself have learned more in the past decade than I did in the 5 decades before it. Mostly what I've learned is what it means to be more wholly human. Just for a moment, I'd like you to think of a few adjectives that describe you at your best. Just let your mind filter to a few adjectives that describe who you are at your best. I'm so hopeful that each of you now have a few. Now take a few minutes to think about a few adjectives that describe you at your worst. Who are you at your worst? So now the $64,000 question. Which of these lists describes who you really are? Is it not obvious that you're both, along with some gradations in between? Isn't that a more complete way of describing yourself? Isn't it true that you can be the worst of yourself, but that that self is not all of who you are? And that you can be your best, but you're not always your best? This is what I believe true growth and development, personal evolution, are really all about. Seeing more and excluding less. I am today still that person who made that fateful decision at 33 years old to write a book with a man named Donald Trump. That will be part of my story to the very end. The instincts which prompted the decision haven't disappeared, but I'm vastly more conscious of them now, and I have commensurately more capacity to manage them, to make conscious choices about how I behave in the world. I've also grown immensely over the past 3 decades. My perspective is wider and deeper and longer. I see my shortcomings more clearly, and I trust that my strengths are real and enduring. I don't spend nearly as much energy as I once did, and as Donald Trump still does, trying to prove or defend my own value. The result is that I have far more energy available to create value in the world. Loving oneself is no easy matter, the psychologist James Hillman once wrote, because it means loving all of oneself, including the shadow, where one is inferior and socially so unacceptable. Thus, the cure is a paradox requiring 2 incommensurables, the moral recognition that these parts of me are burdensome and intolerable and must change, and the loving, laughing acceptance of them just as they are, joyfully and forever. One both tries hard and lets go, both judges harshly and joins gladly. Seeing more and excluding less, accepting what Zorba the Greek ruefully called the full catastrophe and embracing it. This is called a whole life. This is the life Donald Trump has never lived and never will, but you could. And I deeply hope you will, because to whom much is given, much is expected. Thank you.
Tony, thank you so much for that truly insightful talk. I'd like to start off with a very difficult question. What are 5 adjectives that describe Donald Trump at his best?
That is a difficult question. You know, I've been asked many times, what are his redeeming qualities? You know, everybody has redeeming qualities, and it was embarrassing to me not to have an answer to that for some time. He is persevering. He is aggressive in pursuit of his goals. I'm running short.
That's one, I think. I think that's perseverance.
Perseverance. Here's the thing. If you took Donald Trump's perseverance and aggressiveness and applied them to a virtuous goal, he would be very effective. There's plenty of energy. There's just the wrong quality of energy.
Interesting. And when he announced his candidacy, coming down the golden escalator, holding your book, did you write him off like everybody else, or could you see this coming?
I felt a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach when he got on that stage and he said, America needs the man who wrote The Art of the Deal to be president. First of all, I didn't think I was qualified. And second of all, I didn't think he was qualified. And third of all, I thought if he would lie about that, when it was so, not only so patently untrue, but so easy to disprove, then he would lie about anything. And yes, in your answer to your question, I thought from early on, not the very earliest, but early on, that he could get the nomination.
And going beyond the nomination, how likely do you think it is that the polls are wrong and there are a lot of quiet Trump voters and that he could actually be in the White House in January?
Well, I would say I wish that the WikiLeaks weren't happening. And, you know, I'm also mindful of the fact that this is a large room and there's 400 or so people here. And I, in a sense, present it as if this is the consensus. And I recognize that there are people in here who probably have a very different feeling about Donald Trump than I do. And the reason I've been speaking out is not to take issue with his policy positions. I happen not to agree with them, but because I believe his characterological deficiencies are so great that they preclude his being president, and that whatever the smoke and mirrors that are created in the course of a campaign may make people believe, I lived with this man day and night for a year and a half, and I have no doubt that my assessment of his character is accurate. And there unfortunately isn't virtually anybody else who's had as close a relationship with Donald Trump who didn't sign a non-disclosure agreement and therefore isn't talking about him.
And to those sort of divided opinions, I want to read you a quote that Michael Moore, something he said very recently, you might have seen this in the news. He said, "Whether Trump means it or not is kind of irrelevant because he's saying the things to people who are hurting. And that's why every beaten down, nameless, forgotten working stiff who used to be part of what was called the middle class loves Trump. He is the human Molotov cocktail that they've been waiting for." Do you think this is an accurate portrayal?
Dead on. Listen. We need, as a society in the U.S., and given Brexit here and Marie Le Pen in France and nationalist movements all over the world, all over the Western world, we need to recognize that Trump didn't come out of nowhere. Trump came out of a deep discontent. And what was that discontent? I would argue that the primary reason for that discontent is the tremendous income inequality that has emerged. It's the dark side of capitalism. It's a whole group of people, like the ones Michael Moore described, who grew up believing that they were as entitled to the American dream as anybody else and had been used to working crappy jobs but getting paid reasonably well, having some version of that American dream, a nice car, a house, a certain amount of security. And then all of a sudden, the world gets filled with a small number of people like Donald Trump who control a vast percentage of the wealth, and they're out on their backsides. And the irony is that Trump ought to be their enemy, but the reality is that they have reason to be angry. And it's not a surprise to me that the most disenfranchised people in our society who are white, because Trump has been so virulently hating towards so many minority groups, but for white people who are disenfranchised, I get why they're for him. And a lot of the reason I'm speaking out, is in the hope that I can temper that anger with the recognition that this man doesn't care about them.
And why don't these disenfranchised white people feel represented by the Democratic Party?
Why aren't they?
Yeah.
Because Democrats and Republicans are in large measure equal opportunity offenders when it comes to the income disparity and to the over embrace of a free market. You look at the choice the Clintons made after they came out of office, and it was to run up their advantage. And that itself is a source of enormous anger in people. Why they're not angry at Trump for bringing in workers from overseas and having his products made in other countries is a mystery to me. It's not a complete mystery. The one other factor I would say that makes sense to me is Trump is not a traditional politician. So they are saying to themselves, and maybe some folks in this room are saying to themselves, he could be a savior. I'm desperate for a savior. He could be a savior. And I'm going to throw caution to the wind, because at this point, almost everyone understands that this is a man with some pretty serious limitations. But it's a measure of the anger that it's overcome by the hope.
So let's talk about those limitations with regard to the campaign. For many people, the line between the campaign's strategy and its buffoonery is quite blurred. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, how contrived is the campaign? Are the blunders planned? Are the scandals relished? Or is this literally just screw up after screw up?
It is literally screw up after screw up. I mean, there is no planning in the sense that Trump runs the store. Make no mistake, the reason you see tweets from him that are self-immolating and crazy is because nobody controls him. He does what he wants to do. And there's not some aide standing next to his bed at 4 a.m. when he gets the impulse to send out a tweet. The campaign is a almost perfect reflection of the man.
Great. And my last question before I pass on to the audience is, how do you think he is going to deal with losing if he loses?
You're making me anxious. First of all, I'm very superstitious, and I don't want to say that he's going to lose, even though I desperately hope he loses. It would be a true black swan event for him to win. But it was a black swan event for him to win the nomination. So I don't rule it out. Having said that, I do expect him to lose, and I do not expect him to go quietly into the night. He has kept upping the ante as a drug addict would. The drug addict wants more, wants more cocaine or a pure dose of heroin, because they're forever chasing the high. Donald Trump, when it comes to attention, is forever chasing the high. And so when this election ends and he feels, listen, much more mentally healthy candidates for president than him have gone through extended periods of depression following their losses. It's a huge public loss and humiliation. But Trump is not available to depression. He just won't go there, I don't think. So instead, he'll go to anger. And he will drum up that anger that's sitting inside his supporters in any way he can to provide evidence that he was wronged, the election was rigged, and he didn't really lose. Trust me when I say this. When Trump loses the election, he will never acknowledge, he will not concede the election, and he will never acknowledge that he lost the election. Because to do that is to feel obliterated, and he's not going there. So it's going to be a dangerous, tense time in America in the weeks after the election.
Thanks. Very frightening. Now, if you do have a question, put your hand high in the air and wait for the microphone to come to you, and then it would be ideal if you could stand up. If we go to the girl in the third row over there, yes.
Many would blame the current state of the U.S. media and journalism for the rise of Donald Trump. And if you agree with that view, I was wondering what your opinions are about the U.S. media in this presidential election. And if you agree with the critics, then what do you think needs to change to prevent this kind of Donald Trump situation from happening again?
So I actually don't believe that the media is a huge factor in Donald Trump's winning the Republican nomination. And I'm saying the nomination because the media's perspectives changed dramatically since the election, and I actually think the media has done a very good job of bringing Trump's shortcomings to light since the election, since the nomination. The reason I don't think that they played that big a role is because I think the force that was driving Trump was bigger than the media, and I also think the simple truth about journalism is you go where the story is. And
rightly or wrongly, it's very hard to resist Trump as the story. He just is very good, and here's a capacity he has. He's an unbelievably effective manipulator of the media to get attention. He's no longer an effective manipulator to get positive attention, but he is capable of getting attention. In terms of what I think will happen or should happen, I think that introspection in the media has already begun. I've had a lot of conversations with the reporters who were traveling with the candidates in the last several months because of the role I played, and I think a tremendous bridge has been crossed, and that positive bridge. That bridge is the recognition that, quote, objectivity is not actually giving equal attention to two sides of an argument if one's argument is completely and utterly without credibility. And so you'll start to see now, you have started to see in headlines, things like Trump lied about X. That's typically something you see on an editorial page. It's appropriate on a news page when it's factual.
Thanks. Could we go to the gentleman on the front bench over there?
Thank you very much. So my question is whether you think that Donald Trump leads his constituents or whether Donald Trump's constituents lead him. As in, do you think that these policies were originally coming from him and he recognized later on that they would play so well, or whether he, by some method, found out that this was really kind of at the beating heart of America and therefore took up these policies and became their standard bearer?
It's a complicated a question because when he came down from that escalator to announce his candidacy and he said, the people streaming in from Mexico are rapists, that was not spontaneous. He'd been planning that line for a long, long time, and he had figured out quite some years earlier that he could stoke the fears and interest of a certain constituency by creating a polarized world and setting up, in this case, Mexicans, but subsequently Muslims and blacks and women and, you know, virtually everybody but white men, as the enemy. So I do think that there was a lot of conscious thinking about this. What's interesting to me over the last 6 weeks since Steve Bannon has taken over his campaign, Steve Bannon is a, you know, leader of the what's now called the alt-right, but, you know, in the old days would have been called the Ku Klux Klan. And I have watched very clearly the influence of Steve Bannon on Trump's declarations, and I actually believe that the closer it comes to his loss, to his losing, the angrier and more like the alt-right he becomes. So it's like a powder keg, people already angry, Trump not originally angry, just wanting attention, now angry, and boom, that's explosive.
Thanks. There's a woman in the white top in the second row there.
Leading on from that, do you believe from your experience with Trump that he is a racist and that he is a misogynist?
Yes and yes. Yeah, I mean, I had to stop and think about it. There's no question he's a misogynist. I mean, that speaks for itself. Think about, I had this analogy that, you know, when I was a reporter, wrote an article in a newspaper, this is pre-internet, and I got, you know, a dozen letters about it. That was considered a lot. In fact, the assumption was that it reflected the desire of 1,000 people to have written. But the only ones who took the initiative were those 12. In the case of those 12 women who've come forward to accuse Donald Trump of assault, of sexual assault, they had to cross one heck of a barrier to do that. I mean, what possible gain is there for a woman to subject herself to ridicule and humiliation by Donald Trump, a potential lawsuit, the peeping Tom inquiries of many people about the details? So my assumption is that there are hundreds and hundreds of women, out there who were sexually assaulted, or if not sexually assaulted, sexually approached and weren't willing by Donald Trump. Ergo, misogynist. As for racist, my experience with him was that he had a peculiar kind of racism, just as he has a peculiar kind of anti-Semitism. To just throw in a third one. The racism, he actually had huge admiration for a small group of black men. They were fighters, prize fighters, and football players. If you were a prize fighter or a football player, Donald Trump admired you as a black man. If you were virtually anybody else, you were not admired. And then as for Jews, you know, his attitude toward Jews, and of course his wife has converted and become a Jew, but quite honestly, I don't think that makes a damn bit of difference to him. He's no more friendly to Jews than he would have been before that, except her maybe. He sees Jews as really, really effective people to handle his money. So he likes Jews who are accountants and lawyers. The rest of us, not so much.
Thanks. Let's go to the person in the red top on the front bench there.
One thing that this election has seen is the traditional Conservative Party having to completely change to adapt to his form of conservatism. How much do you think the vacancy in the Supreme Court has affected that, and will that swing the election?
Has affected what?
The current support among traditional Republican leaders.
For Trump?
For Trump, despite scandals.
Well, listen, I mean, I'm a, you know, I have very progressive views and have always voted, not always, but mostly voted Democratic, and it would take a really bad Democrat in this election for me not to vote for that person. If Donald Trump were a Democrat, I wouldn't. But the reason would be the Supreme Court, because we are at a historic moment with the Supreme Court where the future of that court will be determined for 40 years, probably, by the two or three or maybe even four appointments that are possible during the next 4 to 8 years. So if I'm thinking of myself as a conservative Republican, I get that there are a lot of them who are holding their noses as hard as they can and saying, you know, and you know, being upset with what he's saying, particularly evangelical Christians, being upset with what he's saying, but feeling like I just got to do it because the shape of the world that will emerge is so influenced by the choices of the Supreme Court.
Tony has better eyesight than me, so he's going to pick someone who's sitting at the back.
Yeah, the gentleman with the beard holding the high hand. Or, do you have a beard? That is, you were trying to figure, you do. You, yes, it is you. Well, does $70,000 a year mean that they're educated? That they have a college education? I would say no, it doesn't. $70,000 a year in the United States is an amount you can earn in a variety of ways. An Uber driver with no education could earn $70,000, and a factory worker in a good union could easily earn $70,000. So I'm not sure that's convincing, that it's educated people, that it's as many educated people who are for him as we think. But listen, to your point, the faith among all kinds of people at all income levels and all levels of education in the once sacred institutions of you know, the society, law enforcement, the clergy, politicians and the government, virtually every one of those has lost respect and esteem. And there are a tremendous number, millions and millions of people who are feeling unmoored and unprotected and uncertain. And I think when you play on fear, fear taps into a different part of the brain than rational appeals. And Trump is really good, as many despots and authoritarian leaders have been, at stoking people's fears. So if you get a person to feel fearful enough, they might have a PhD, but the level you're talking to them at is the level of a six-year-old. So that helps to explain why smarter people who should know better don't necessarily behave better. I'll go back to the back with the, no, I should go to a woman, so I'm called misogynist. Here.
So you worked with Trump over 30 years ago, and now you see him on TV and running for president. Is there any, let me not call it development, but change in his character that you can see? Because, I mean, you've talked a lot about how you've changed over the years. So how has Trump changed, if at all?
It's a fundamental principle of the work we do at the Energy Project that you can't change what you don't notice. And Trump doesn't notice. He was just quoted the other day in Michael D'Antonio, one of his biographers released a whole series of tapes of interviews he'd done with him, and he was quoted saying, I'm not willing to look inside myself because I might not like what I see. So my experience of Trump is that he's very much the same person he was when I met him at 38. And that he was very much the same person at 38 that he was at 13. I had a wonderful experience that speaks to this and maybe is a good way to end. I've attended the debates, and I've been fortunate enough to sit up very close. So when the debates end, I'm able to go right up to the stage and kind of experience what the back and forth is. So at the end of the third debate, the final debate in Las Vegas, I walked up to the front, and there was a sort of roped-off area where they were worried about what was going to happen there, and they wanted to make sure they were protecting those two candidates. So I was standing sort of as you might if, any celebrity were walking by, like as if I was a fan, and a lot of others were lined up there, and Trump eventually walked the line. And as he walked the line, he would say, "How are you?" and lean out to shake the person's hand. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then he gets to me. And he reaches out his hand and he says, "How are?" "Oh, it's you. Oh God, it's you." And he pulls back his hand. So I don't think he's changed much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Tony Schwartz. Everybody join me in thanking him. Stay seated while we leave, but have a good day.